Let's do a quick review. Well, last time we talked just a broad scope of a review. We talked about Sophia theoretically, talked about Sophia historically. Hopefully that's all. This is all from last spring. Hopefully that should, you be able to come up with at least a basic understanding of what Sophia is theoretically, Jungian psychology, how she's been seen historically. We talked about typical dream images, if you remember, starlight, board games, dual mandala, DNA. And then I mentioned something which I think is, you probably can't say too often in this work. Always ask yourself, what image are we working on? You get stumped. Because our mind is used to thinking in thoughts, and we're not thinking in thoughts. We're thinking with images. So if you ever get confused, okay, at least where am I? What image are we talking about? And then I tried to list what I thought were the main images that we talked about so far throughout the whole course. Sophia as a hot wind. Sophia as something that's trodden in the mire. Can you all remember that? Mm-hmm. Sophia as starlight. And then Sophia as the rising dawn, hence the title of the book. The rising dawn would represent, as would the stars, the luminosity of the unconscious. Does that all sound familiar? Luminosity of the unconscious. Then we looked at, we kind of slowed down again, and we looked at four points last time. On page 207 in the quote, that night shall be light. And I'm not going to repeat the argument, just to remind you. The idea there basically was that light was equated with the light of Christ. And the idea behind all that being that what the author is doing is equating his experience with ecclesiastical imagery to distance himself from the heat of the experience, to say, oh, this is Christ. And that spares him the dilemma of actually having the Christ fire within himself. And it eliminates the danger of inflation, but it also shortcuts the possibility of integrating the experience. But we'll see him going back and forth between many states of mind, which always happens when you wrestle with some hot emotion yourself. We talked a bit about moonlight being an image of Sophia, and I presented a dream. And the dream, if you remember, was making this very basic point that describes Sophia as about living from the inside out. Finding out who you are from the inside and bringing that to the world, rather than letting the world tell you who you are, in one of a variety of ways: parents, society, community, church, neighbors, and then adapting to it. We talked a little bit about Sophia and as being in the text on page, that by the way is on page 209. Page 209 to 210, we talked about Sophia as being equated with the lapis. The idea there was that just as the lapis is created through a process of transformation, so Sophia, when she's experienced, initiates a process of transformation whereby you become conscious of her. So that we've said this many times here, that this text is both about Sophia and it's about alchemy, because alchemy will be the process of transformation whereby this raw experience of her can be refined into a change in personality. The other implication was a Gnostic one, in that the lapis was said to have light in it. And we talked a little bit about Gnosticism, and we talked about how Jung used Gnosticism as one of his main metaphors for the process of living, where the self is lost through the first years of training and education, and it's as if it gets scattered everywhere in the world, and then it comes back to you piece by piece through your life experiences. So that each life experience you have that's of a significant emotional nature is another piece of you coming back. And to that end, I came across a marvelous letter of Jung's, which I thought I'd read you part of, where he talks about this. This idea then that Sophia will come to you. I mean, any aspect of the self, but here we're talking about Sophia, will come to you through an outer experience which has gotten hidden in it, an inner meaning. And that inner meaning is to communicate to you a piece of who you are. This is from his letters, volume 2, page 195. It's a long letter. I'm just going to pick up kind of midstream. He's responding to this guy, Arvind Vasavada, who actually, I guess, used to live in Chicago. He's now deceased. And Vasavada wrote him, calling him the perfect master. Salutations, perfect master. Well, Jung wasn't going to sit for that. So he responds and says why he doesn't like to be called the perfect master. And he says, you all seem to be interested and how to get back to the self. This need to have somebody that you idealize. To get back to the self instead of looking for what the self wants you to do in the world. Where, for the time being at least, we are located, presumably for a certain purpose. The universe does not seem to exist for the sole purpose of man denying or escaping it. But as a young man, but as a young man does not stay in his father's house, but goes out into the world, so I don't look back to the self, but collect it out of the manifold experiences, and put it together again. That's the key phrase. You collect it out of the experiences of life, and then you put it together again. What I have left behind, seemingly lost, I meet in everything that comes my way, and I collect it, reassembling it, as it were. In order to get rid of opposites, I needs must accept them first. But this leads me away from the self. I must also learn how opposites can be united and not how they can be avoided. As long as I am on the first part of the road, I have to forget the self in order to get into the mill of the opposites. Otherwise, I live only fragmentarily and conditionally. Although the self is my origin, it is also the goal of my quest. When it was my origin, I did not know myself. And when I did learn about myself, I did not know the self. I have to discover it in my actions, where it first appears under strange masks. That is one of the reasons why I must study symbolism. Otherwise, I risk not recognizing my own father and mother when I meet them again after the many years of my absence. Powerful. 195, 196. Letters, Volume 2. So that's the his description and letter of this idea that the lapis has light in it, and that light is in the and that is a Gnostic image, which refers to the fact that the consciousness, so to speak, is embedded in matter, and that is when we go through life's experiences, we get pieces of ourselves, we remake the self in the In the emotionally charged experiences that we have, we find that piece of ourselves and add it to ourselves. And that is a rebuilding of what was there at the beginning.
What does he say, too, about the strange faces? I mean, he said something in there.
About his parents?
Yeah, I don't know if it was about the parents, or just, I think there's just sometimes when, about getting to know yourself, I think there was a strange mask or strange, what did you read in there? But there's something he said about that.
Yeah.
But I think, in my experience, I think as we get to know, I mean, there are times where we're just at a strange point where we're not recognizing this aspect.
Right.
That's strange.
So I don't look back to the self, but collected out of manifold experiences. Is that what you're?
Yeah, you were just reading. I don't know. It was something that it had the strange.
Oh, I have to discover it in my actions where it first appears under strange masks.
Strange masks. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. It kind of reminds me when, after supposedly Christ had risen, and the disciples are out in the boat, and they see some guy on the beach cooking, and then they didn't recognize him at first. And I think it's interesting, you know, with that, it's really powerful when they just didn't recognize. And then when they did, they jumped in, and then he revealed himself. Or herself, or however you mean, but it's that whole thing of, I don't always recognize that. Mm-hmm. It's under a strange mask.
Yeah.
And it takes time not to be afraid of that or run away from it, or, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it's very scary. Sometimes the experience is so painful or difficult, mm-hmm, that you don't want to deal with it. Okay. And then it's even scarier to realize it's meaningful.
Yeah. That was good you said that.
Yeah. So that's and you can see what we've said now in different words is kind of what we've been saying about Sophia all along, that she's not separate from physical experience. She's not separate from the events of time and space. Spirituality and the events of time and space are two different things, because the events of time and space are little pieces of that self that are trying to help you discover your meaning and your place and your work and your task and who you are in this life. Mm-hmm. And of course, so Sophia has as one of her main homes Gnosticism. She's that piece of God often that's walked in the back. So that was, I thought you might enjoy that letter. That was page 209, 210, the relationship between Sophia and the lapis. And then we ended on page 210, 211, 212, with that image of the woman, Sophia, with the crown of the kingdom of the twelve stars. Is that what it was? The crown of the kingdom shining with the rays of 12 stars, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. That's where we left off. And remember, we talked about that they are two references to the book of Revelation. And in the first reference, that is the woman standing on the moon with, I think, the radiance of the sun in her face and a crown of stars on her head. And she's pregnant and she's about to give birth, and she has to be whisked away at birth because the dragon is waiting to eat that child. And that we interpreted as, within the Christian myth, at that time there was a pregnancy. There was a trajectory of development of the myth itself. The Christianity was in need of evolution, and within itself something knew that. But it couldn't happen then, because, doesn't say that here, but we would say the ego wasn't strong enough to carry that experience, or to let that experience unfold. So it had to be put on hold for 2,000 years. And the other image then is that in the book of Revelation, the one who is prepared as a bride adorned for her husband, which is the epithet used to describe Sophia here, is the New Jerusalem. and the New Jerusalem descends, so adorned in its bride is Christ. Its bridegroom is Christ. And again, you have a similar idea there in that there is a wedding, but it's above the earth, and therefore not yet ready to be realized in time and space. So twice you have images which represent change in the pregnancy and in the marriage, and in both times they occur above. They're not able to be brought down to earth, which is that change that could not happen in Christianity at that time. But with this vision, you don't hear anything about it being up. You hear about this individual who fits this description coming to us, which indicates that that change is now ready to happen.
And I think you were saying, too, in the beginning with the eagle needing to be strong enough to carry.
Right.
That's a big part of, I think, a lot of the inner work people are doing right now, as you believe, as far as, I feel like a lot of the groundwork, you know, I've done for like 20 years has been, you know, I mean, preparing the ego to handle, you know, more, or the more the union of its opposites.
So what is that transition, right, and why does it need a strong ego? Talk about that.
Yeah.
In a way, I'm just asking you to tell me back what we've already been talking about, but to put it now in the context of Christian theology. What is that transition?
Well, would it be because the responsibility comes to us now instead of...
Responsibility for what?
Of growing, becoming more conscious.
Yeah. And how does that occur?
It occurs by paying attention to... our dreams and working at it.
Right. The idea is that the nature of religious experience is changing. And, or let's say, it might be better to say, because I want to now make a bridge to astrology. That's kind of what I'm laying the groundwork for. It might be better to say rounds out. The original idea, which became the theology of Christianity, is this separation between the spiritual world and the instinctual world. And the spiritual world was the good world, and the instinctual world is the bad world. The flesh, the body. So that you can see that in the history of Christianity, how what really preserved Christianity were the monasteries. And they are getting above. Very often those monasteries are physically above the geography, are getting above the material world. But with this Sophia image, we are contemplating another understanding of what religious experience is, and that it is something that comes through the body, comes through the material world, as we talked about in that Gnostic letter.
Basically, for the second coming of Christ, the cosmic Christ, or something.
Well, I think you could. I think you could certainly put that in such a language that's how Jung would interpret the second coming. That in that original formulation, there was a knowledge within that formulation of the need of its evolution. And that was in the two images of revelation that we were talking about. And the other is this idea of a second coming. There needs to be a return and a development, return to and development of what this religion is about.
On the inflation, you know, we talked about the first three chapters, that he was inflated.
Yeah.
And he was saved. How was it? By his surrender to the, or how?
Well, we're going to see him doing all sorts of, going through all sorts of things. What he does to save himself in the moment is he links his experiences up with dogma.
Okay. Because, I mean, this really gets fascinating for me in the whole next, all these other chapters.
We're just starting.
I got into the whole thing about that word inflation kept coming up, so I kind of started doing the study, you know, and just what these pages here.
Yeah, hold on to that, because that really is the danger.
Right. The warning, you know. And
if we're looking at a new, I say new, that's probably not quite fair, an enlargement of what we understand by religious experience, then not only do we see religious experience as something that is apart from the physical world, which is a valid way to look at it, but there's also such a thing as religious experience, which is in and through the physical world. And that's what Sophia is about. It's where you get your spiritual direction from an experience which is instinctually overpowering, or, as he talked about in the letters, in which there's some encounter with reality that's problematic. Now, the problem there is you don't get the meaning of the experience immediately. You have to work on it. You have to pluck the meaning out of the experience. Remember, we talked about that woman who had the affair. And over time, then, she began to realize how her life should change. The experience itself doesn't immediately appear to give you the direction. It just seems like an overpowering experience. But if you're familiar with this metaphor, and if you're certainly working with your dreams, you'll see in it, like we saw in her dream, of the diamond, images of the highest value associated with what otherwise seems like a low experience. But what we have to do then is alchemically, so to speak, go through a process of transformation, or bring our consciousness to begin to question the experience until he knows the answer. What is the new direction that's being communicated to me out of this experience? Well, if the ego is weak, it never gets to that point. It just stays stuck in the experience. And no reorientation occurs. That's why the ego has to be strong. And that's why the ego could not, on the whole, wrestle with this dimension of religious experience 2,000 years ago, because it was just getting burned up by the instincts. Roman antiquity was so decadent, and the instincts were such in such chaotic state, that people who had such experiences simply identified with them and then acted them out, either sexually or physically or violently or politically. Only now, after 2,000 years of Western history, is the ego strong enough to come back to this experience and to begin to work with it. So that's why we see in Revelation this new dimension of experience that we're talking about couldn't have happened. And why we see its first, I think probably its first knocking on the door around 1200 AD with these visions of Thomas. This is what those visions were trying to tell him, but how in the world would he ever recognize it? Basically tell us through him, there's a transformation of religious experience going on. And here's what it's like, and it's about Sophia.
When you talk about the second coming of Christ, can you think about it? I think about it in terms of Christ consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so my idea of second coming is that we now, in this Christ consciousness, bring that to this material world that we live in, and we see the marriage of the two.
Well, this is a little different. This is different, I think.
Well, it comes up in a couple of pages about walking the florist, the three ages, and that shift. That he's also from the 1200s as well, and he was articulating this. So it seems like this material is trying to come out of right of way through the existing church, and some other material that's on the internet suggested that because of what he was saying was so potent. That the visions that he had were so potent that they gave Francis permission to create his order, the Franciscan order,
yeah.
Which would embrace some of this sort of natural philosophy.
Right. You could see it sort of eking back in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. I think you said last time, but was the symbolism then of the baby being born that was snatched up of what is happening now?
Right.
Okay.
Right. It's happening now, and we got the preview in Thomas's visions.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
But you can see a link between 0 BC to 1200 AD and now. Now the question is, we could look at why now? And I thought we could take a little excursion to Jung's Ion. And I think some of you probably are familiar with it, some of you probably aren't. Is that fair to say on both counts? Just real basic. Jung's astrological, I'm going to call it astrological view of history. That's probably not quite the best way to put it. But and before I embark on it, let me just say that he isn't talking causally here. But something struck him as interesting, that if you interpret the, and I'll explain this term in a moment, procession, it's not precession, it is precession, P-R-E-C-E-S-S-I-O-N, the precession of the equinox. I'll explain that in a minute. If you interpret the precession of the equinox in astrology, it has a kind of coincidental thematic parallel with a macro view of Western history. Let me try to explain that. Let's go start with the precession of the equinox.
Say that again. Coincidental what?
Parallel with the macro themes of Western history. I always get defensive when I talk about this because I have people jump in and say, "Oh, are you saying that history is caused by astrology?" No. But he thought, isn't that interesting? There is this parallelism of symbols. And he uses that then as really a metaphor for trying to understand Western history. What's the precession of an equinox? Well, you know, the Earth goes around the solar system like this. But the Earth is turning like this, right? Once a day. But it's also wobbling. And the axis of the Earth makes one complete wobble every 26,000 years. So it's really moving in three directions. It's moving around. It's moving around the sun. It's moving on its axis, and its axis is wobbling. You ever play with a gyroscope and how they wind down, they go like this? Well, that's what the sun, that's what the Earth's axis is doing, but so slowly, and it takes a little bit. It's a 26,000 year rotation. Now, see if I can say this without getting everybody crazy. Summer is when our axis is leaning in towards the sun. But if there's a 26,000 year wobble, when the Earth has returned here after 13,000 years, 13,000 revolutions a month. Sorry, 12 times 13,000 months. It's going to be here. So it's not going to be summer anymore. It's going to be winter because of the wobble. So there is a slight play in the celestial mechanism, might be a way to put it. And when it is summer, it's going to be over here. Like this. Is this making sense? Well, here it's summer. When it's over here, it's summer. And when in 13,000 years, it'll be summer when it's over here because of the shift. Is that making sense? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to do it just two extremes.
But it's 26,000 years.
13,000 years.
Oh, yeah.
And then 13,000. Now, are you with me so far? Because it gets more complicated. Think about at sunrise, when the sun is coming up, you're going to, because you're here in this part of the solar system, looking out this way, you're going to see one set of stars. When you're over here, when the sun comes up, and you see where the sun is at sunrise, you're going to be looking at a whole other bunch of stars. So the stars you see at sunrise are going to change a little bit from year to year because of this shift. Is it making sense?
Where are we in the evolution of this?
We are now at that point when the sun rises. Now, I tried to make it simple by going summer, winter. But actually, it's called the spring point, the precession of the spring point. When the axis is here, when the axis is here and the Earth's here, we are now seeing when the sun rises, if you could see the stars and you knew your constellations, you would see the sun against the backdrop of the cusp between Pisces and Aquarius. So that these constellations around the sun have been each named, and each constellation is 1/12 of the space that we see from the Earth. What he's concerned about is how so if I use the word now, spring point, you okay with that? Spring point is the point in the heavens that we see when the sun rises. And because of the wobble of the Earth, that changes. It changes every 26,000 years, and it changes 1/12 or one constellation's worth roughly every 2,000 years, every 2,200 years, more or less. So the sun is in a different sign every 2,000 years, more or less. The constellation you see at sunrise, due to the wobble of the Earth, is going to change every 2,000 years. Well, at the beginning of Christianity, the sun was at the end of Taurus, I think, right? Mm-hmm. At the beginning of Pisces. At the beginning of, at our era, the sun is just at the end of Pisces and the beginning of Aquarius. That's the age of Aquarius. Another way to call those 2,000-year periods is an age. And I think they're called Platonic years. One Platonic year is one complete 26. One Platonic year is 26,000 Earth years.
Platonic month.
Platonic month. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes, Platonic month. One Platonic month is an age. One Platonic month is 1/12. Are you still with me? I went through all that to give you really a kind of a spatial image of what we're talking about. And now comes the important symbolic thing. The image for the age of Pisces, which is where the sun has risen at the first day of spring for the last 2,000 years, is a double fish. There's a vertical fish, and there's a horizontal fish. Jung said that is symbolically meaningful because there have been two phases of Western civilization in those 2,000 years. There's been a spiritual vertical, and there's been a material horizontal phase. Each phase has been 1,000 years, roughly. So this is how he begins to understand Western history, as there being a development of the main themes which have driven us, which are coincidental. Of course, we know about coincidental, quote unquote, with the symbols of astrology. To suggest there is a macro theme in Western history.
Well, that's hermetic. I mean, as above, so below. It's a wonder people can't stand it to say stuff like that. Driving crazy.
Yeah, it's definitely, you probably wouldn't want to talk just to most history professors unless they were enlightened, but it's almost an oxymoron, I think.
Harness's book is all based on this stuff.
Whose book?
Paul Harness. He came and lectured. I'll think of it, I'm sorry. It's fabulous. It's all based on this. He's a
fabulous. But this is at Pacifica.
Pacifica.
Yeah, see, he's. Yeah. Pacifica will stand it, but most places won't stand it.
He's actually a professor at the Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco.
Yeah, either California or Pacifica.
Sister Western Thought. It was on the bestseller list for a long time. It's a fabulous book if you want a good history of Western Thought. He does it beautifully. We're in the age of Sophia. I mean, he shows how that.
Now, with respect to what I want to try to do now is link up what I've just told you and what we've just said about the Book of Revelation, imagery in the Book of Revelation, the imagery in Thomas's visions, and what that means for us now. Jung felt that another parallel between the history and symbolism is that those two fish are representative of the two poles within the God image. Within the Western God image. And they're the two poles being spiritual and material. And the first phase then of Western history was dominated by the spiritual half of the God image. But because life seeks wholeness, the second phase of history from 1000 on had to be based on the pressing in of what had been excluded, namely the material aspect of the God image. So you had spiritual experience in the first half, and you had material experience in the second half. He goes into it in quite a bit of detail, which I don't think we need to do. But basically, if you want just to epitomize things for yourself, think of the monasteries. Building the monasteries is the first half. And they're up, as were the Gothic cathedrals. And the second half of the second 1,000 years would be the age of exploration, imperialism, where the main effort of humanity in the first 1,000 years was this vertical axis between the individual and God. The main activity in the second half of those 2,000 years is the horizontal exploration of the world.
So that is the age of Sophia, what we're coming into, the connection.
Now, so the two sides of a God image have played themselves out historically. And that story has come to an end. And there's another stage being prepared. And again, Jung goes to astrology. Where the first stage was fish symbolized by fish in water. The second stage is symbolized by Aquarius or the water carrier. You interpret that in the first stage, in the first 2,000-year period. The main image is the fish as Christian, contained in the water of dogma. And even though you might say, well, what's so Christian about the age of exploration? Jung figures that's just another form of Christian spirituality lived out concretely. You know, and look at the religious motivation for our imperialism. It's all done in this talk of saving
when in fact it's just rank imperialism. But that's an effect of the swing to the other side, because the first half was so spiritual. But as I said, that story is coming to an end, and what is required now? Now he begins to not just make an analysis through these images, but begins to play with them. So what is the next eon going to be like if there is some basis to see the theme of history in astrological symbolism? And what he comes up with is that we have to now contain the dogma that we were once contained in. We are no longer the fish in water. We are no longer the believers who believe a certain doctrine. We are the carriers of that doctrine. Well, see, that's what Sophia is preparing the way for. Because Sophia, you don't worship in a system, but you have an experience, and you find the inner parallel within yourself to what has been an external system. So that Sophia is the bridge between eons. That's how this fits in, how Sophia fits in historically. And why it is at this moment that Sophia is so important.
So she's not the next stage. She's the bridge.
Well, she might be the next stage. Yeah, she might. I don't think we know. She's certainly our task. And that's why I think these visions of Thomas are so important, because his unconscious is telling us, hey, here's the next task. Here is, and it's not just a personal task, it's a cultural task. Here is the way for religion to evolve. And we saw the necessity of its evolving in those two images from Revelation, which reappear in his vision in a different way. So the way I put it is, it's now time to integrate Christianity. And that gets some people upset.
What do you mean by integrate Christianity? What are you saying?
That what would the I should have brought another quote. I don't think I have it. Darn it. That what we once thought were descriptions in an outer way of metaphysical truths, we now see are all parts of our own psyche, to which we have to establish a personal relationship. Now the CTSers in the world get really upset when I talk like this. They go.
I was in class yesterday, theology and the Bible.
Uh huh.
I said, Vicky's saying, oh, well, don't forget some of the Baptists.
Oh.
Well, that doesn't negate the fact, I mean, the idea that, you know, there isn't something outside us.
Well, that's what I'm getting to. I just didn't think to bring this to it. Maybe I'll see if I can find it. I don't think it's in the letters. I don't think I find it quickly enough. But Jung makes the comment that the evolution of religion occurs when a particular understanding or a particular representation of its religious truths are ready to be taken on the subjective level. And that prepares the way for a new revelation. So the way I like to think of it is, we're dealing here with the evolution of Christianity, and we are now able to integrate what has been revealed and take it as a psychological truth. And when we do that, we will be preparing the way for another generation to get a revelation of a new form of religion. But the new revelation can't occur until the old revelation has been integrated. So that it isn't saying that God is nothing but psychology, which is what some people will accuse us of. But it's saying what we have thought was theology, we now know is psychology. And we can integrate that. And it doesn't mean that there is only psychology. It means that we are now able to take responsibility for what we once considered to be divine. And that will pave the way for a new appearance of the divine. Now, whether that's Sophia, who knows? But this is how I understand it, and how she goes into astrology here, which is why I wanted to go to it. And also to try to put this for you in the historical perspective, where this all fits in Western history and the spiritual challenges of our time. This is really, as I've said before, the spiritual challenge of our time, and this is why I've said this.
It seems to be parallel to what you said about working with dreams, that if you, until you can solve the dilemma or whatever, figure out what the symbols in the dream were, or once you do, that new elaborations are presented
yeah.
in future dreams, and it evolves and develops, and the path becomes clear. Well, that's in the microcosm, everybody is interested.
Exactly the same thing.
What you're talking about.
But there's an evolution of cultural consciousness. Just like there is an evolution of personal consciousness that goes on. And
a lot of expressed there's a conflict within the God image.
Yeah, that's how it has been expressed, yeah. And where I think it gives our own individual work some dignity. This is what we're trying to do in our work, is find a way back to a felt knowledge that my life is being meaningfully guided outside my ego in a way that is not in conflict with a devotion to life and time and space.
Okay.
Yeah, we're trying to come into the experience of our life being guided by something outside my ego, and have that guidance come through experiences in the real world, not apart from the world anymore, and really. Often the most difficult experiences of the real world. Lust and hate. Some people are lucky. I think most people attracted to Jungian psychology aren't lucky.
Did you say the mystic or tendency?
Yeah. You know, now.
People in every age that sort of pave the way to consciousness that allows us to be where we are now.
I do. And I think, depending on how you read it, you can even justify this from the New Testament. But it is certainly not what Christendom has made of it. Mm-hmm. And what Christianity has made of it. Yeah. And I think she will look at a quote. We'll look at a quote from a mystic here pretty soon, and we'll see that even there, you can notice the basic tenet of Christianity is that the light is the good. And what we're saying is the dark is the good. That's one of the big differences.
Mm-hmm.
And see, you had those two poles lived out in the two phases of Western history, as you were talking about. The light, the first thousand, the dark, the second thousand. But everyone then talks about that dark as secular. And what Jung is saying, no, it's as sacred as the light. We just have to go back to both poles and find them internally. And see their connection with the spirit as he has defined it, as we've defined it, to heal the split between Christianity and Western civilization.
Don't you think we'll have another church? Will it have another church? Or outside of the group?
It's a very good question. It could be that the church, because it's really the question of what's the role of community in this. And I think here Jung Institutes and the church are just the same. So don't feel that I'm picking on the church, because I feel the same about my profession. People go to the group as the substitute for a relationship to themselves. Now, if we are lucky to ever make this transition to where we begin to collect ourselves out of our experience, you know, like we talked about this letter here, and actually begin to establish a relationship, maybe then people will go to that community to celebrate that connection, which is probably what it really should be in the first place, rather than as a substitute for that connection. So I don't see that the church has to diminish, you know, but maybe the character of the church will change. It will be a community of realized persons instead of a crutch for people who are too lazy to really look at themselves.
Give a round of applause for that
remark. If anyone who's traveled Europe and gone to any of the great cathedrals, name one, pick one, whatever, but you know they're constructed along certain lines to amplify the voices, the, you know, spirit of the community is lifted and raised up. It becomes almost like a generator spiritual experience, and that's why they see what they are. It's so overwhelming. They're huge, massive, they're beautiful, there's carvings everywhere, but also when the congregation voices are lifted, it actually acts as a sort of a transporter, like on Star Trek or something, you know? And I think that is missing in our modern experience of religion, and I think we still have some of that in some of the sacred architecture and the sacred spaces we can enter into. We can still, so what I'm saying is we have church, you know, physical sense can probably help serve that role, but it's not going to be the dogmatic version of the
character will change. I don't know what's going to happen, and honestly, in a way, I don't even care, because I feel our task at the moment is this, and I do think it's going to have some effect in history for children, grandchildren, great grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But I am just so interested in what we are capable of doing with our meager tools, only to a few people, but it could conceivably be the beginning of something, and that's where I choose to put my energy to watch how can this process happen, how can we best facilitate it, what do we need to learn to do it, and so on.
I have a feeling that as far as the churches go, they'll have to be empty.
Yeah, it could be.
That's
yeah.
And that's happening in
New Zealand.
Nobody
goes to church.
You know, I belong to Matthew Hardenberry Parish here, though, and Jeff Godecker is amazing. I don't know if you know him, but he's so, and this stuff is just right up his alley. So I go and talk about Archetypal Mary. I just gave a lecture last week about the Great Mother as the archetype. You know, they're very open to that conversation. People are hungry for it. Mm-hmm. So I think there are very subtle ways that it's beginning to happen in certain places. While at the same time, the Bishop of Portland just said anybody that works in my ministry has to sign a confirmation of faith. You have to agree to so many things and sign off on it. So, I mean, it's a distance in this turmoil right now.
Yeah.
In that chaos, I do think it's going to be an emergency. I don't think it's going to go away.
Yeah.
I think in the Testament Peter read very powerful. And many people are starting to do that. But I don't want to spend too much time on that.
Well, that takes us pretty much through then chapter 5. That page 212, 213 is the astrological dimension of the Sophia experience, which I've tried to help to put out. Same 214. Page 215 just is something we talked about at the very beginning of class. I don't know whether you remember or not, but she's just saying there that there are two parts to the book. We finished part one, we're moving on to part two. And part one was the presentation of the experience, and part two is going to be about the integration experience. And I've got to warn you, the book gets harder. Part one is nothing compared to part two. It is really tough, but I think also all the more interesting. Yeah, it's needed. So he's had the experience, now we're going to see what he does with it. And that takes us over to 217. Do we have a break?